Welcome to the CCA edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the cholangiocarcinoma community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent with Rare Disease Advisor. I'm here at the 25th World Congress on Gastrointestinal Cancer, taking place in Barcelona, Spain. We're talking with Dr. Jennifer Knox, Professor of Medicine at the University of Toronto and a staff medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. Dr. Knox is considered Canada's top expert in cholangiocarcinoma, which has been one of the primary focuses of her career over the last two decades. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Very nice to be here.
Dr. Knox, what has changed in cholangiocarcinoma research and treatment in the last 20 years?
So it's been really a remarkable change in the last 20 years. So cholangiocarcinoma is part of an umbrella, part of a group of tumors called biliary tract cancers, either intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, gallbladder, ampullary. And they used to be just lumped together as one sort of bad group, kind of like pancreas cancer doesn't do well, doesn't have a lot of options. We've had a sort of standard of care chemotherapy for more than a decade now, and there's been very little progress until the last few years when we started to recognize that these subgroups are actually very different. They have characteristics where they overlap, but they're also very different molecularly. And we've moved into this era now where we recognize that cholangiocarcinoma is almost a poster child for precision medicine, meaning if you can individualize the treatment for a patient because you have studied their tumor genetics or their mutations or their vulnerabilities, and there's just more and more drugs coming available that target those vulnerabilities or those genetic aberrations that then are now leading to improved survival. So we've gone from really a cancer that had almost no options and a bad prognosis to one where we're actually starting to really tease out subgroups that are living longer and longer.
Okay, so cholangiocarcinoma traditionally has had a poor prognosis. Can we estimate a five-year survival rate for this disease?
I think if you take all comers, it's still under 20%.
So one-fifth of all patients will still be alive after 5 years post-diagnosis?
Yes.
And that hasn't changed much in the years that you've been treating the disease?
Well, that's a hard question because it takes a little time to see how that data will change. I imagine it is changing, but I don't think we have new data, to show that. What we can show is that when patients get access to these treatments, especially if it's targeting something unique in their tumor, that we are seeing survivals that we hadn't seen previously. But, when you average everything in, it's hard to move that needle. And so it'll be interesting to see, say, an update in the next couple of years if that five-year survival has really improved.
Right. Now, can we talk a bit about risk factors? We know that certain things do cause cholangiocarcinoma, obviously liver fluke in Southeast Asia, exposure to certain agents such as dioxin, Agent Orange, and then perhaps asbestos, and then some other factors. But around the world, there are varying rates of prevalence. In the United States and Canada, I'm assuming they're equally rare.
Yeah, no, it's very rare in the West, and we probably have different etiological risk factors. Certainly not all well understood, but certainly any chronic cause of inflammation in the biliary system, like people who have autoimmune bowel disease that leads to a disease called primary sclerosing cholangitis, leads to a risk of biliary or cholangiocarcinoma. Gallstones are well recognized as a risk factor in women with getting gallbladder cancer. If you're born with sort of anatomical drainage issues that lead to reflux in the liver. These are all recognized risk factors.
Did you say inflammable bowel disease?
Yes. So people who have ulcerative colitis also develop this autoimmune disease of the liver called primary sclerosing cholangitis. And this is dreadful because these are often very young people, young men in particular, that then get this cholangiocarcinoma when they may be only 30 years old.
So this is
40.
Early onset cholangiocarcinoma.
Yeah. Yes.
So having IBD is a risk factor.
Yes.
I see. What about smoking, alcohol consumption? Are those not factors?
I don't think it's strongly linked, no.
Okay, what about ethnicity? Is that also a factor, as far as you can tell?
There's certain parts of the world that have a certainly higher prevalence of biliary tract cancer, like Southeast Asian has higher risks of gallbladder cancer, South America as well. It's not fully understood why that is, but other than that, no.
I see. The standard of care in North America, both the U.S. and Canada, has not changed all that much for most of the time you've been studying.
No, it has just recently. So just last year, there was a positive trial called TOPAZ-1 in which immunotherapy was added to the standard chemotherapy that we've had for, 15 years, which is gemcitabine cisplatinum, with an improvement in median survival. So that is the first general advancement in some time, and it was a very welcome one. The more that data matures, the more you see that there's a tail on the curve of the survival curve that's basically showing that some patients do particularly well.
TOPAZ-1, that's the trial in which it was shown that durvalumab plus standard of care is a viable option for cholangiocarcinoma.
Yes.
How significant is that?
It is very significant because it really brings cholangiocarcinoma into a modern era. And by modern era, there's lots of things that define that, but immunotherapy is obviously a very important sort of egg to crack. And while the benefit of immunotherapy in an all-comers population is still modest, the potential to learn further about who are the ones that really benefit from that and really get long-term survival because they got it's coming. We don't know yet, but it has to be there because it's really made an impact. And that data was very quickly embraced and has moved into standard of care. So people were really ready for that change, and it's also well-tolerated. So it makes it a lot easier to consider for patients.
And what about treatment options in Canada? Is Toronto, that's it for now?
Oh, no. The care for cholangio patients across Canada would be very uniform, would be very good for the standard of care for surgery. But, getting these clinical trials with all these novel agents based on genomic profiling of a tumor or blood sample probably isn't readily available everywhere. And it's really where there's been a real change coming over the last couple of years. So if I have one really strong message, I really think people have to biopsy their patients and get the tumors profiled. If they can't get enough tissue, and it's a bit challenging in some cholangiocarcinomas, then there are the blood assays, the liquid biopsies, and you would miss really great opportunities for patients if you don't do that.
Well, you did mention the importance of genomic testing and individualized, you said personalized precision medicine, specifically with this cancer.
Yes, there are numerous targets. They're rare, but we find them. And if you add them all up, you might argue today that almost 40% of these patients, you'd find something that you could then act on.
So in general, you think it's a hopeful time for this particular disease?
Yes. Especially after this meeting, a lot of updates on some of these targeted agents were presented, and we're not just seeing novel targets, but we're seeing next generation of drugs that are better than the, we're seeing second and third generation FGFR inhibitors that can overcome the resistance that the first ones came to. So we're seeing nuanced care. Mm-hmm. We're seeing presentations in which people are arguing that when you progress on your targeted agent, it's worth reprofiling to see what has changed in the mutation, and then offering another agent, probably on clinical trial, and then rescuing the patient's disease control again. It's just amazing.
One of the things I wanted to ask you is that I've heard common criticism that in Canada, it's great if you have diabetes or hypertension or heart disease, but if you have a rare disease, it's harder to get treated in Canada because of the system, and many patients cross the border and go to the U.S. for treatment, especially when they need very specialized genetic testing and counseling and that kind of thing.
So no, I don't think that's entirely true. I think any rare disease, no matter where you are, you're going to suffer if you don't get to someone who has experience or expertise. So cholangiocarcinoma, like any rare disease, you probably need to go into a center of excellence and see people who have had experience so we can offer more options than the average oncologist, who maybe only sees one of these every 2 years, is not going to have the same options that, say, someone like me who sees three or four a week.
How many patients have you seen over the years with cholangiocarcinoma?
Oh, it would be hundreds. Mm-hmm. Just hundreds, yeah.
Interesting. Sure. One of the presentations or the posters here talked about the possibility that a BRCA mutation could be related to cholangiocarcinoma.
Well, no, we've known that for quite some time. It's not many, but it certainly is one of those. Well, it's a predisposition, but also something that maybe we could drug in the future.
I didn't know, for example, a breast cancer, ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, those were all well-known cancers that are related to this mutation. I was not aware, for example, that cholangiocarcinoma could also be related to BRCA. Yep. How strong is that link?
Well, I think it's not quite as strong as breast cancer, but certainly it's well understood that cholangiocarcinoma is another one of the cancers that's at risk. Mm-hmm. I treated a father and a daughter years ago that were BRCA2 germline, and father had cholangiocarcinoma, and then daughter had breast cancer, and then cholangiocarcinoma.
Did she survive?
I think she survived her cholangiocarcinoma because it was localized and could be treated with resection. She did not survive her breast cancer in the end.
I see. Will you be presenting any important papers during the rest of this conference or at any upcoming conferences soon?
So unfortunately, I did present a randomized trial at this meeting that was trying to look at a novel drug, sort of a drug intensification chemotherapy for all comers, but it was negative. So that was disappointing. A lot of studies that have in cholangiocarcinoma tried to intensify the chemotherapy in recent years have failed, and so I think the strategy is to would back off from that and move more towards optimizing the treatments that we have. So we're not getting rid of chemotherapy. We need chemotherapy, but super intensive 3-4 drugs is probably not the way to go. These patients can't handle that, and the toxicity is a problem. So the gemcitabine cisplatinum is probably here to stay. We've seen that adding durvalumab, the TOPAZ, has been helpful. We saw some data here, very early data, that a novel IDH1 inhibitor added to chemotherapy seems to have a good response rate. So that's important because that's about 20% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas. So I think the future is going to be, you see patients, you get them stabilizing on the standard of care combination while you're having their tumor studied. And then when you find a mutation, then you spend, as an oncologist, spend a little bit of time trying to line up how they're going to get that drug, whether it's funded or whether it's through a clinical trial, or do they have to travel somewhere to get
it? Or a compassionate use?
Or a compassionate use in some cases, right. Yes. And so, because you don't want to miss those opportunities.
Here's kind of a random question, and then we'll running out of time, so we'll wrap it up. Canada is a world leader in cannabis. And it's one of the first countries that legalized cannabis. And we've seen a number of studies that talk about medical marijuana to relieve the side effects of chemotherapy and used in conjunction with chemotherapy. And I'm wondering, in this particular cancer, could cannabis play any role?
So I think cannabis is a part of sort of supportive care. Has certainly become much more common in recent years. I think it's very patient specific. I've had patients that do not derive any sort of comfort, any lack of nausea, any increased appetite. You know, maybe they just get all the sort of bad side effects and they get confused and things. And then I've had other patients that it's been really helpful to get them through it. So I see it as a nice complementary side. I don't have to prescribe it. It's readily available. It's not an easy cancer to get through. So anything that helps people, you know, other people have other strategies.
Whatever helps.
Whatever helps. You know, we try to reduce a lot of the side effects of the chemotherapy. But these diseases like cholangiocarcinoma really do play on people's appetite. And so that can be very helpful.
Dr. Nux, we're out of time. Thank you so much for speaking with us. It's been very interesting. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.